But anyway, so we're going to talk about leadership in one thing or another, but do put on your calendar a 60-city or 50-city book tour means every major metropolitan area he's going to be coming through. And then so we can tie that into your martial arts school and do a variety of things when he's coming to town anyway, which would probably be very useful for everybody. But let me grab him and his daughter. We'll get going. So everybody got those dates?
Yes, sir.
November is a little tough on me, but just after.
Okay. So if you will, zap me an email or something like that.
Fair enough.
And if we can work around those dates, we'll work around those dates. Again, all of them are very tentative. I still got to talk to the diving school and so forth. But anyway, Commissioner, I don't know if you want use of that, but you're welcome to. But I was just giving them the background. Everyone here got the biography that I sent out a couple weeks ago, right? So without further ado, let's welcome Commissioner. Greg, are we recording?
We're recording.
Okay.
Hi.
How are you doing?
How are we doing today?
Everybody good?
Great.
Good. First, I want to thank Master Oliver for the invitation to come in and talk to you a little bit today. And given that we're at West Point, I don't think there's a better place to talk about leadership. And that's sort of what I want to talk about. If you have any questions about anything I say, you can ask. If you have anything to ask regarding any, regardless of what I say, and ask that too. To start, I'm going to tell you a little bit about myself, give you an idea of where I came from and how I got to where I've been. I have lived sort of the American dream. I came from very humble beginnings. I was abandoned by my biological mother when I was 3. My mother was murdered when I was 9. She was beaten to death. I was born in Newark, New Jersey, not far from here. I was raised in Paterson. Not a very nice area. And how many people in here have seen the movie Lean on Me? Well, I went to Eastside High School before Joe Clark cleaned it up. About five years, I guess, 8 years. When I went to Eastside, I was probably one of the 25 white kids that was in that school. It wasn't a center for education. It wasn't a center for learning, unless you wanted to learn how to fight. And that's why I went to high school. I dropped out when I was 16. But before I dropped out, when I was 13, going on 14, I got involved in the martial arts. And this is a long time ago. And I studied under a number of different instructors. Most of them early on in my martial arts training was Japanese styles. And I studied under some real legends, if you will. Initially, I studied under Ed Kaloudis in Clifton, New Jersey. He was very close to Gary Alexander. I studied under Jerry Thompson, Goshen Dope. I went to a tournament one time in New York City, and I saw a couple of Japanese instructors in Goju. One of which was, his name was Aaron Banks. And I liked him, so I went to New York and I went to Banks School. Then I went to a big tournament, and I saw an instructor named Peter Urban. Peter Urban brought American Goju to this country back in the 50s. And some of the best in the country. And I went to these guys at this tournament and said, where's your school I'd like to go to? He says, well, if you'd like to go there, you'll figure out where it is to go there.
Okay.
So I asked one or two more students at this tournament, and I got the same answer. So eventually, I figured out where Peter Urban School was, and it was in New York City. It was in Chinatown on this deserted street. And this is back in, giving up my age here, this is back in, 1972. New York City was a rough place, and I used to take a bus from Paterson, New Jersey. I'd go into New York City, go to Port Authority, get on it. Now I was 13 years old, I was 14. My mother had no clue that I was even out of the state. I would go into New York, I would go to Port Authority to the bus station. I'd go downstairs to the train, and I would take the subway from Port Authority down to Chinatown. I'd get off in Chinatown, I'd go to the school, and then I'd come back. And there were good parts to this, and there were bad. The bad part is that my classes were extremely difficult, and I'd be extremely tired at the end of the night. And I would take a train back to Port Authority. I'd get on a bus right around 9:30, and it was about a 30 to 40 minute ride back to Paterson. And the worst part of my entire martial arts training was that I would sometimes miss my bus stop. And that bus would take me to the other end of Paterson. And I never had the money to take the bus back, so I would have to walk. So I had to walk about 2 miles to get to my house. And that was the easy part. The bad part was I had to walk without getting bugged or shot or killed. That was the bad part. But I did that until this all started in 69. We didn't get more, I'm going back further. It started in 69. I did that right up until about 1972. I got my black belt, my first black belt. 1974, I joined the U.S. Army. And I decided I wanted to go to Korea. And off I went. And before I went there, between 72 and 74, I studied under YJ Chang in New York City, a Korean stylist. He, at one time, he was one of the vice presidents for Kukiwanto, the 10th Taekwondo the World Taekwondo headquarters in Korea. I studied under him for a while, and I was a rising national champion until I decided I'm going to the military. 1974, I joined the Army. I went to Korea. I was a military police officer, and that was the beginning of my career. Prior to that, I was a high school dropout who liked to fight, who was involved in the arts, and lived in a pretty bad neighborhood. The military police and the martial arts in the U.S. Army basically changed my life. I stayed in the military for 3 years. I got out. My last duty station was Fort Bragg, North Carolina. It was the home of special operations and special forces units. My last 6 months in the military, I taught unarmed combat self-defense at the John F. Kennedy Unconventional Warfare Center. That is where all of your special operations, special forces, Navy SEALs, that's where they go for a lot of their unconventional warfare training. I taught there my last 6 months. And then I got out. Wasn't sure what I was going to do, and I'm going to speed it up from here because it's going to take about 3 days. I finished my military time in July of 77. I worked for a federal task force, an investigative task force, for about 18 months. I then went on to Saudi Arabia. I worked for the government of Saudi Arabia for 2.5 years in a security capacity. I came home. I went back to North Carolina as a cop for about a year, year and a half. Moved to New Jersey. I became a correction officer. was a training officer for a new sheriff's department in New Jersey. And then I went back to Saudi Arabia again. This time for about 18 months, I worked for the King. I worked for the King's Hospital. I was the director of security, the chief of investigations for the royal family's medical facility. I went back to the sheriff's department. I had left and taken a leave of absence from this time. When I went back, I was the commander of training and special weapons and operations, SWAT, if you will. I stayed there, and then I went back to Saudi Arabia. When I came back from Saudi this time, I was the commander of SWAT, and I ultimately became the warden of the Passaic County Jail in Paterson, New Jersey, and I was 31 at the time. I was the youngest prison administrator in the country, probably. I had 1,100 inmates, 250 people that worked for me, and I don't know, about a $15 million budget or something. And I was a rising star in the law enforcement community. I had gotten my GED by then, did not have a high school diploma, I mean a college degree. And but I had a lifelong desire since I was a kid. I wanted to be a New York City cop. And when I was in Saudi Arabia, somebody worked for me who was retired out of the NYPD, and he told me I should take the test. So I took the test for the NYPD, and ultimately, now I'm the warden of the Passaic County Jail, the chief of my department. I have gold shield stars, I have a car, I have all the perks that comes with an administrative job, but I still wanted to be a cop. I had taken the test, and I get a call from the NYPD. All right, you're in. What do you want to do? My investigator for the NYPD said, you are completely, utterly nuts if you take this job. He said, you're sitting in an office. You have all the perks of this job. You're making double what you're going to make if you go to the PD. And you're crazy. New York City, the crime rate was at its ultimate highest back then. This is in 1985. I strongly urge you not to do this. On July of 1986, I resigned my position as warden of the Passaic County Jail. I drove over to Brooklyn Technical High School in Brooklyn. I stood in a room with 2,400 other airmen. I raised my right hand. Took an oath, and I joined the NYPD. And it was a great day. I thought at the time I did the right thing. 14 years later, I knew I did the right thing. My time in the PD went pretty quick. I started out as a patrolman. I walked a foot post in Bedford-Stuyvesant, Brooklyn. 6 months later, after the academy, I went to Times Square. At Times Square, I worked uniform patrol and plain clothes. I used to ride around, you all, I would imagine one time or another, you've been in the city or seen the city in movies. Well, when you see all those yellow taxis, when you see those yellow taxis in Times Square, I'll teach you a little trick. On the top of the taxi, there is a number, a letter, and two numbers that follow every cab in New York City. When you look at those cabs, and you see a number, a letter, and then two numbers that are exactly the same at the end, there's a really good chance that the people in that cab are cops. There'll be three people in that cab. There'll be one private and two people in the back seat. They're all cops. And that's what I did. For my last 6 months in Midtown South in Times Square, I was in what they call anti-crime plain clothes. I had long hair. Well, I had hair, period. It was getting long. And I was pushed to go to narcotics. And ultimately, I got accepted to go to narcotics. I wanted a detective shield. In law enforcement, there's this thing, the coveted gold shield of the NYPD, that's what I wanted. And the fastest and easiest way to get there was to become an undercover in narcotics. That's the good part. Bad part is you're an undercover. rights as a cop. You pretty much give up your identity. You are pulled and extracted from the computers in the NYPD. You are terminated for cause officially, or, you know, as far as the PD goes. And you are sent out into the communities to buy drugs. That's your only job. I had hair down to the middle of my back. I had six diamond earrings and a big gold loop. I wore a gold ankle bracelet. I had a big goatee, big beard, and I looked terrible. My operational areas at the time, now, as you'll notice, I'm white. My operational areas was Harlem, Spanish Harlem, and Washington Heights. And I was there in, they call that Manhattan or Dakar. I was there for about 18 months, almost 2 years. During that time, my whole function in life was to buy drugs. And it was a pretty bad job. I roamed the streets, I bought in the streets, I bought in apartments. I was involved in a few gun battles. My partner was shot. I lost 3 very close friends that were shot and killed over that 2-year period. And then I got transferred, promoted, and sent to the DEA task force. DEA task force is a task force that consists of New York City police detectives, New York State police officers, and federal DEA agents. We started an investigation on the streets of New York City that ultimately took us into the jungles of Guatemala, Costa Rica, Brazil, and Ecuador, and Colombia. Over the next 2.5 years, I seized in excess of 10 tons of cocaine. Enough cocaine that would fill the front of this room. $60 million in cash, and extradited, including kidnapping some of the highest ranking members of the Cali cartel, bringing them back to this country. During that time in 1992, Rudolph Giuliani was running for mayor. And I volunteered to do a lot of security for his campaign. And ultimately in 1994, he becomes the mayor of New York City. By then, I was his friend. He knew about my work in the Passaic County Jail. And in May of 1994, right after he became the mayor, there was a massive riot at Rikers Island. Within a week or so, I get called by him, go to Rikers. I want you to take over the Investigations Division, the Internal Affairs Division for the New York City Department of Correction. I did that for 6 months. I was promoted to First Deputy Commissioner. I did that for 3 years. That's the number two guy in charge of Rikers. Now, keep in mind, when I was in Jersey, I had 250 people working for me. When I ran the New York City Department of Correction, I had 13,000. I had $1 billion budget. Still didn't have a college degree, but I was working on it. And I was responsible for 133,000 inmate admissions per year. I was the commissioner. I was the first deputy for 3 years. And the commissioner resigned and retired, at which time I got called to City Hall, and I became the correction commissioner. I took over Rikers. I was there for 2.5 years. In August of 2000, I get a call from the mayor on a Friday evening at 11 o'clock. The date was August 19th, at which time he told me that he wanted me to take over the New York City Police Department. Still didn't have a college degree. I was still working on it. And I went from having 13,000 staff members to 55,000. A $3.2 billion budget, and basically responsible for the 12 million people that work, live, visit, go to school in the city of New York. And I had that position for the next 18 months until Rudy Giuliani left office. And when I took the job, it was pretty simplistic. Keep crime coming down, enhance employee morale with the cops and enhance community relations. No problem. Easy. For me, it was easy. I could do it. I'm pretty good at what I do. I didn't see any problems, and we were on a roll. Over the next 13, 14 months, crime dropped another 15%. I was dealing with the communities. I was dealing with the cops. I had been a very, very aggressive cop. I was highly decorated. The cops loved me, and everything was going smooth. Everything was going great. I was ready to move on with my life. I had already decided I was leaving the NYPD. I was going to retire when Rudy left on January 1st, 2002. And then something happened. And that something was that happened. It was at 8:46 in the morning of September 11th, 2001. I was in my office. I just finished working out. I was actually standing in my bathroom shade. And my chief of staff came and started kicking, banging, trying to knock down my outside door to my private area. I came out and I said, "What's up?" He said, "Plane just hit Tower One." I said, "All right, relax. It'll be okay." Because I thought, as maybe most of you did, that that plane was a small plane. Some of those planes that fly up and down the Hudson River. And I figured I was going to go into my conference room, look out the window, and see the tail end of some Cessna sticking out of the building. That's not what I saw. The World Trade Center, actually, where that land is on the other side of that river, that's about how far my office was from the building. And if I looked out my window, I had to look really high up in the air. But as I looked out that window and I looked up, I could see almost through the entire building. From the corner we were on. I went into my office, I called the mayor, he said, "I'm on the way to the towers. I will meet you at 7 World Trade. Now 7 World Trade was across the street from Tower 1. Vesey separates the two. And 7 World Trade is where our New York City operational center was, the emergency management center. That's where we would command any incident in New York City. We would come in. That's the mayor's office of emergency management. I got in my car, my advance team, the bodyguards, everybody went down there. They were waiting for me, and as we drove down West Broadway, our vehicle was stopped before we got to Vesey. And the cops ran up to the car and said, "You got to back up the vehicle. You can't get into 7 because there are people jumping from 1. And as I stepped out of the car, there were a bunch of people that were jumping off the top of Tower 1, and they were landing on Vesey between 7 and 1. Also, Tower 7 had taken an enormous amount of damage, the brunt of damage. When the building blew out, a bunch of the stuff hit 7, and the whole front of it was on fire and damaged. I tried to call the mayor. Cell sites were down. Couldn't get through on the phones. We got through by Nextels. I told the mayor I would meet him at Barclay and West Broadway. He came about 3 minutes prior to the mayor's arrival. I turned around to get one of my guys to call for a temporary command unit, one of these big buses. It's a big, enormous bus that's a command center. It's a temporary command center. I called them to get a temporary command center to put it on that corner. And as I turned around to talk to my chief of staff, there was this enormous explosion above. And as I looked up, if you have seen some of the footage from September 11th, when the second plane hits Tower 2, it hits the south end of that building and it blows out the north end. I was standing under it. And as that plane came through that building, I looked up and all I could see was that big, huge fireball. And the building basically blowing up. Then it took me about 5 or 6 seconds to realize that that stuff that's going on up there is coming down here. And at that point, between me and the bodyguards, they drove me up the street, got me behind the federal building. There was a post office there. And we stood there, stayed behind that building for about 10, 20 seconds until the initial debris came down to the ground. In fact, we were so close that one of the a shaft from one of the wheels of the plane hit one of my security guys in the back of the leg as we were running up West Corridor. So we were pretty close to the brunt of the damage initially. And it was at that point that I realized we were under attack. Up until that, I had no idea. And then everything changed. The response to the event for the city all changed. Because not only did we have to worry about what just happened, we had to worry about what else is going to happen. Is anything else going to happen? Do they have attacks planned on the ground? What's going to happen to the mass transit system? Are there other explosions? How many more planes are there, if there are any? All of those were questions that was running through my head at the time. And we don't have an Air Force in New York City. And I can remember, I make light of this now, it's sort of a joke. And it was a joke in the aftermath, but on that day it wasn't so funny. I turned around my chief of staff and I was screaming, I need to get air support and I need somebody to shut down the airspace. And I just blurted it out and told these guys that's what I wanted. Well, about 3 weeks later, when it was relatively calm, we're sitting in an office with my chief of staff, and he looks at me and he says, hey. And no, he's looking at me, he's laughing, he's smirking, he's smiling. And I said, what's so funny? He said, I was just thinking of something, you know, about on 9/11. I said, what was funny about it? He said, dude, do you remember yelling at me, Tel Aviv, close down the airspace and get the air support and all that? I said, no, not really. He says, yeah. He said, you were screaming. Shut down the airspace and give me air support. He goes, I remember turning around to the guys. He goes, look, we got that 800 number for like, let's call a fire jet. He says, this is a police department. We don't run the airports. The reality is, I really didn't have to tell anybody anything because at that point, our aviation guys, our helicopter guys, had already notified the FAA that the second airliner had hit Tower 2. We knew we were under attack. Our aviation division called for air support. There was a bunch of other stuff in motion at the time that I didn't even know about. But it was an issue. And it wasn't thought, at least. But it was that day, for the history of New York City, it was our worst. I lost 23 people that worked for me. The Port Authority Police Department lost 37. And New York City Fire Department lost 343. We lost 1,700 civilians. When Tower 2 imploded, the first one to go, basically, Giuliani and I were in a Merrill Lynch office on the corner of West Broadway and Barclay. He was on the phone with the White House. He was trying to get the president. The president was traveling. He was in Sarasota, Florida. But they said, the vice president's going to come to the phone if you could just stand by. In about 20 seconds after he started that conversation, somebody got on the phone and said, listen, vice president and the White House is being evacuated. They think the Pentagon is just going to hit. So you can relate this to timing. When the Pentagon got hit, all right, when you look at that day, when the Pentagon got hit, is about 30 seconds to 60 seconds before that tower imploded. Because as Rudy Giuliani hung up that phone and looked at me and said, that's not good, I said, what is it? He said, I think they said, the Pentagon's just with you. And I'm looking at him, and I can't even get my head around what he's saying. And then all of a sudden, everything in the room we were in, now we're in a building, we're in a big building, that entire building started to shake like a freight train was coming through the wall. And then within 10 seconds, it went completely black. We were covered in dust and had no clue what had just happened. But we knew it was something big. And then for the next 25 minutes, we were trapped in that building. couldn't get out, luckily for two maintenance guys that sort of, I don't even know where they came from, they sort of moseyed out of somewhere, opened the door, all these doors were locked in the basement of this building. And they came through, had keys, and they got us out of the building onto Church Street. We went up to Church Street. The entire administration, basically the mayor, the fire commissioner, me, all of our staff, we had a roaming command center. Went up Church Street, and as we were going up Church Street, Tower 1 imploded. We heard it, we didn't see it. We felt it, we didn't see it. So from that point on, the entire operational aspect element of New York City had changed. We didn't have a command center because our command center had just been bombed. I couldn't put anybody in police headquarters because I didn't know what the other targets were if there were other planes, and obviously I knew now there were other planes because the Pentagon got hit. By the time we got to a fire station on Church in Houston, we heard that there was a fourth plane that went down to Shanksville. Now we were four planes. So there were a bunch of people who wanted the mayor to go back to City Hall. And I used to tease the mayor about this all the time, that I saved his life a couple times on that day. But one of the times is when his staff insisted that he go back to City Hall, and I went up to him. And there's a bunch of this, the reason I tease him, there's a bunch of footage. You know, when you look back at the 9/11 stuff, you'll see me run up to him, and I grab him by the arm, and I say, listen, you're not going to City Hall, you've got to go north, you've got to get out of here. And he says, okay, we'll go north. Well, had we listened to the guys that wanted to go to City Hall, we'd have all died, because we'd have walked behind Tower 2 to go over to City Hall, and that's when it imploded. So we started our emergency operation base out of the New York City Police Academy. We stayed there for 3 days. And then within a matter of that 3 days, 72 hours, we rebuilt the New York City Command headquarters in Pier 92. And I'm talking a command center that housed every New York City agency, every New York State agency, the military command components, and the federal government components, all of which were involved in the Emergency Operations Center. An enormous amount of work, all done within 72 hours. And from that point on, we basically managed the crisis. And I say manage the crisis, and this is something important for you as school owners, as business leaders, as people that may run into a crisis, have a crisis. This is, there can't be anything more important to responding to crisis than actually managing the crisis. And I say this for a reason, and I'll give you the difference. I'll explain why. On September 11th, the first time I knew we had a problem was at 8:46 when that first plane slammed through the tower. I didn't have any advance notice. Nobody told me that plane was coming. Nobody told me we should be prepared for this. Nobody said that. Unlike Katrina. They had 7 days' notice. They had 5 days' notice that those levees were going to go. They had 3 days' notice that this now wasn't a possibility. They're gone. When that storm hits, when the eye of the storm hits New Orleans, those levees are blown out, and this entire community is going to be washed away. There was no doubt in anybody's mind that was going to happen. And yet, New Orleans, Louisiana, that entire area was nowhere near ready. So here's the two differences. Here's the two things that are big, huge differences in crisis management. One, planning, preparation, preparedness is an absolute must. You have to be proactive. You have to be preemptive. You have to plan for the worst. In crisis management, you have to be prepared for the worst. And then you hope for the best. But it's all about planning and preparation. From 1996 up until 2001, through the operational command centers, through the emergency command, emergency management center for the mayor, we constantly did mock drills, tabletop exercises, different crisis management practical strategies. And I can remember, I was correction commissioner. I ran Rikers Island. I didn't have nothing to do with the rest of the city. I had my own little world. But on a Saturday morning, I'd get a call from the mayor's office, and they'd say, the mayor has just called a mock drill for sarin gas in the subway. I'm like, dude, I got nothing to do with the subway. Get down to the emergency command center. Why? I have nothing to do with the subway. I run Rikers Island. I run a prison. But here's why. Here's why it's important for every city agency to be involved. Because on September 11th, the correction commissioner, I was the police commissioner by then, but the correction commissioner, he came to every one of those command meetings. You know why he came? Because we'd be at that command meeting and somebody would say, we need body bags. Who's got them? The morgue has this many. We need more than that. Who's got them? Corrections got them. We need mattresses. Who's got mattresses? Correction. Who's got blankets? Correction. Who's got generators? Correction. Okay. That was an agency. On the outside looking in, you would never think that a prison system, a jail system, would have so much to do with a major crisis in another part of the city. It has nothing to do with it. But it did. Not to mention that the New York City correction officers, in actuality, they ran the morgue. We had a number of correctional staff, maybe 100 of the correction officers, the senior correction officers, transferred them to the morgue, and they worked the morgue operations. Because you have to keep in mind, I want you to look around this room. The tables, the chairs, the floors, the ceiling, the wood, the all the stuff. All right. This room is nothing. I mean, it's nothing. This building is almost comparatively, it's like a bathroom in the World Trade Center. All right. Those two buildings imploded. They imploded. I lost 23 cops on that day. I could have given half of them back to their family in this company. Everything in those buildings was pulverized. It disintegrated. It turned into dust. There was nothing left. Nothing. Those buildings were 110 stories tall. And when you think back to those visuals. Remember those big beams that stuck out of the ground, the beams, the elements of the towers that were left? Those buildings were made out of those beams, 110 stories high. Those metal beams weighed 1,700 pounds per linear foot. It was just a little heavy. And it all came down within 10 seconds. So it was the equivalent of like a nuclear blast. So rooms like this, everything in that building, in the aftermath, and I can remember that night, the night of September 11th, there are a bunch of things you may see on the internet. There are shots of me and Giuliani walking through the aftermath of the attack that night, going into the next morning, about 2 o'clock, in the morning on September 12th, we're walking through this maze of smoke and dust and gas and stuff. And I can remember looking around thinking, where is it? Like, where are the chairs?
Where's the walls? Where's the wood? Where's the carpet? Where's the pictures? Where's... There's nothing. It's metal, it's dust, and it's paper. That's it. That's it. Bodies included. I remember when they found the first two New York City cops, I got the call at home. It was early in the morning. I got down to ground zero. I went up on the hill. All the activity had stopped. They had flags out there, all this stuff. I got up there and I said, who was it? They told me who the two cops were. I had 23. I knew them and their families by heart at that point. I said, where are they? And they turned around. They pointed to two orange buckets, Home Depot buckets. And I walked over to the two buckets and I looked inside. There was guns, handcuffs. There was a shield pin, a New York City, a badge. It's called a shield. On the back of that badge, it's sort of unlike any other police badge in the country. On the back of the New York City cops, on the back of the badge, there are two lugs, two holes, like two pins with holes in them. And you take a big safety pin, it's about that big, it's like the old diaper pins. The women that are back from my day, they know the diaper pins, they're about this big. Well, that diaper pin goes through those two holes, and that's how it locks the shirt. That's how it locks the shield on your shirt. A shield pin sitting in the bottom of that bucket. Everything in the bucket is metal. And I'm looking in the bucket, and I said, no bodies, no vests, no shirts, no boots, no nothing. The guns, the handcuffs, all their metal equipment was found side by side, right next to each other. Everything else was gone. That tells you the enormity of the blast. And everything was like that. So we had to deal with that, and the reason I talk about this is because the operations at the morgue, it wasn't like an operation for a fire or for some other kind of building collapse. Because when you have that kind of thing, you have dead bodies. You pick up the body, you bag it, tag it, do what you gotta do, and you move it on to the morgue. Well, in this case, you find a piece of a shirt with a piece of meat that looked like hamburger. That's one piece of a body part. You find a finger. You find a toe. You find, like, just stuff. Every single one of those things was handled as a body part and had to be handled for DNA purposes. Okay? For identification purposes. So we needed extra people at the morgue. We sent correction officers there. And when you talk about DNA, this is something I just wrote my next book. It comes out in February. And I talk about this in my book because people had no conception of the internal operations of what we were doing, and this is probably one of the biggest things we were doing. Where are you from?
Korea.
Should have known that. Okay. If you had a family member in the World Trade Center, and you call up and you say, we think my family member was in the Trade Center, and we now have 2,500, 3,000 people that are dead. Well, we have to identify the remains to see if your family member was identified, was found. Okay? Well, he lives in Korea. His family member was going to school in the United States. So what do we have to do? We have to get DNA from him in Korea. And he may not live in Seoul. He may not live in Incheon. He may live in some village somewhere, God-forsaken village, nobody knows about. Well, we have to go there, and we have to get DNA. You have no conception on how many villages in Scotland, England, France, Korea, that we actually had Interpol agents going to collect DNA. Go get a toothbrush, go get a hairbrush, go get stuff that is going to be transported from wherever that is to somewhere that's going to go from there to their capital, that's going to go from there to Interpol, that's going to go from Interpol to the FBI, from the FBI to the New York City Police Forensic Unit, which is going to be transferred to the morgue, and some guy in the morgue is going to enter that DNA into a database. We did that for probably 25,000 people because we didn't know who was missing and who wasn't. That gives you a bit of an idea of the enormity of the operation. Anyway, we went through the next 3.5 months trying to, one, ensure the city and the country that we were going to be safe, two, securing New York City, three, rebuilding it, repairing it, and four, operational cleanup. We basically started out as a rescue mission, which we realized within the first 3 to 6 weeks that it was unnecessary. There was nothing that was going to survive what we had just gone through. We turned it into a recovery mission, and from that point on, we did what we had to do until I left office on the 1st of January 2002. But I want to step back for 1 second about managing the crisis. For the people in this room that were focused on this stuff back then and watched what was going on, if you think back, you would see me and Giuliani and the fire commissioner and the governor. You would see us 4 times every day. You would see us around 7 or 8 o'clock in the morning, usually around 8. You'd see us around 12. You'd see us around 4. And then you'd see us around 7 or 8 o'clock. And every time you saw us, we had just finished a command meeting. We had a command center that had a table that was probably from this wall to that wall, way back there. And at that command table was every head of every city agency and every state agency. They all sat at that table. And every 4 hours, we would walk into that room, me and the mayor and the fire commissioner. We would sit down, and we would go around the room and say, okay, health and hospitals, foremost, what do you got? Where are we on stats? We have this many bodies. We have this many body parts. We have this much DNA. We have this much whatever. Okay, that's what you have. We need. We need body this many body bags. We need this many blankets. We need this many mattresses. We need this much stuff. We need elf air filters. We need masks. Okay. Where are we getting mattresses? Correction. Where are we getting the air filters? Somebody else. Where are we getting... With every city agency around that table, we went to one at a time to ensure that they told us what they needed. And the reason you have all the affected managers, you have to have every city manager in there, is because if you run the Department of Sanitation and you need ABC, and this guy runs transportation and he's going to give you that or get that for you, you've got to have him in that room. And you've got to make sure that he knows what you need and he's going to tell me, okay, I can do that, and I'm going to send this guy to do it, and I'm going to get this truck, and we're going to do this at this time. Okay. Well, then we come back in 4 hours. And what do I do when we come back?
Same thing.
You do the same thing, but what else do you do?
Verify that.
Who said it? Yeah. That's exactly right. You do the same thing all over again, except this time you go, did you get what you needed? Yes or no. If it's yes, you move on to him. If it's no, then whoever that guy was over here, he's got a problem. Unless he has a really good reason for her saying no, well then that guy has a problem. And the way Giuliani works, I can promise you, you don't want to have a problem more than 2 or 3 times. Because then that seat will be vacant and there'll be somebody else sitting in it. Especially in a circumstance like that. Because at the end of that command meeting, I have to walk out to a lectern and I have to give a press conference. And I can promise you, whatever went on in there, they're going to know about it out there. And they're going to ask us, what was the problem with the what was the problem with the missing mattresses, or what was something? They're gonna know where the problems were, and they're gonna ask what happened. Why wasn't it fixed? Why wasn't it taken care of? You have to manage the crisis, and the only way to do that is one-on-one, hands-on accountability. It's an absolute must. When you think back to Katrina and what happened then, the governor wasn't talking to the chief of police. The mayor didn't talk to the fire department. It was a mess. It was a mess. You only heard from them seldomly. Recently, I'll give you a really good one. Recent, 3 weeks ago, 5 weeks ago, whatever. There was a young man named Michael Brown shot and killed in Ferguson, Missouri. Okay? Good shooting, bad shooting, who knows? It's not been determined yet. But the one thing I can promise you and I can tell you, it was the worst handled crisis I've just about ever seen. Nobody had a clue what they were doing. Nobody talked and communicated with the public. The governor didn't show up publicly for 3 or 4 days. It was a mess. That is not the way you handle a crisis. There was no accountability, none. You can't do that. So we're going to move on from September 11th. I retired in January of 2002. I ended my public service after almost 30 years. And I thought it was over until May of 2003, right after we went into Baghdad and took out, we took over Baghdad, really. The fall of Baghdad, I got a call from the White House. The president wanted me to go to Iraq. And take over the Ministry of Interior for the government. This is after the fall of Saddam. And although I had told my wife that I was done with public service, I also should have told my wife, you never say no to the president. So when he asked me to do this, I accepted, and I was making a lot of money. Well, I went from $1 million to $1.5 million to $140,000 a year, and I took the job. And I went to Baghdad. And I stayed there for the next 4 months until I actually appointed the Iraqi Minister of Interior. I came home over the next 2 years, between 2003 and November of 2004, I campaigned for President Bush as his principal national security surrogate. I did all his campaign stuff when it came to national security. Talking about national security, talking about terrorism, talking about Iraq. In 2004, President Bush got elected, November. Within a week after he got elected, I was contacted by the White House, and I began discussions with the White House in which I was being vetted for a position in U.S. government. On December 3rd, 2004, I was called to the White House. I was nominated by the President of the United States as Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security. One of the ranking positions in the U.S. government, it was the second position of its type. And basically, I would be responsible for security for this country. I accepted the President's nomination, and 1 week later, exactly 1 week later, I contacted the President, and I withdrew my name from consideration, because I had a domestic servant, a nanny, that my wife and I took care of my daughters, this one and one of my other daughters. We paid that nanny cash. Didn't pay payroll tax for the nanny. And as a result, I had to decline the position. My declining the position and withdrawing my name began, one, a media nightmare. Two, a 5-year state and federal investigation where ultimately I was charged criminally for not paying taxes on my nanny, and a number of other things that came up during the investigation, minor tax issues, apartment renovations, and some other stuff.
It all started with an A. In 2009, I pled guilty in federal court to 8 federal felony counts, 5 of which with an A. And I was sent to federal prison for 4 years. I spent 3 years and 11 days in federal prison. I was released in May of 2013 after 3 years and 11 days. And I can tell you that now all that stuff I just told you that I've done, I was pretty confident. I knew the American criminal justice system. I can tell you today as I stand here, I knew squat. I didn't know half of what I should have known. I didn't care about a lot of what I should have cared about. And I can only pray and hope that ultimately I will be judged based on my accomplishments, but more so what I do between now and the day I die with regard to criminal justice reform. And I'm going to talk about this very quickly because this isn't the topic, but I just want you guys to understand what I mean. I put a lot of people in prison. Bad people did bad things. People that tried to kill people I worked with. People I seized tons of cocaine from, millions in drug proceeds. Really, really bad guys. Terrorists, cop killers. I put them in prison for 10 years, 20 years, 30 years life. I have no problem, as I stand here today, with any of that stuff I did. But I have to tell you, then I went to federal prison. And I sat in the room teaching a class, just like this. And in that class, I taught a life lessons class. And I look over at a young black man who was 19 years old. And I asked him what he was doing here. I'm here for conspiracy, for drugs. How much time did you get? 10 months? No, 10 years. He's 19 years old. You got 10 years. How much drugs do you have? Yeah. Yeah, that way, you have 5 grams of cocaine. 5 grams, you know what that is? That's 3 sugar packets in a Dunkin' Donuts shop. 5 grams. We, the United States government, put a 19-year-old kid in prison for 10 years for 5 grams of cocaine. Then I sat around in dormitories and I met men. Commercial, how old are you?
75.
I met men 5 years younger than him. Commercial fishermen. They'd been fishing since he was 17 years old. A commercial fisherman. What does a commercial fisherman do, just out of curiosity? Do you know? Catches fish, right? Is that what you know? Okay. That's what you would think, right? I met commercial fishermen that were sitting in federal prison with me because they caught too many fish. We put these men in prison for 18 months, 2 years, 3 years because they caught too many fish. I met a young guy, he sold a whale's tooth on eBay. You know, it's illegal to sell whales to on eBay. I promise you, you will go to federal prison if you do. Now, I don't want anybody to tell me if they've ever done this. And I can assure you, 95% of the people in this room has done it. Okay. Do you know that when you fill out an application for a credit card, a car loan, or a home loan, do you know that if you make a false statement on any one of those applications, any application that goes to a bank, and false statements being you enhanced your income on that application to get the loan, or a false statement could be that you worked at a certain area longer than you really did so you could get the loan,
Do you know that's bank fraud? And do you know that when you get that loan, and you're paying the loan, it's not like you deprived anybody, you defrauded, you really defrauded anybody, you're going to get the loan. You realize when you get the loan, and you take that application, and you fill it out, and you enhance your income, whatever you say, well, you take that application, you stick it in the mail, well, that's mail fraud. And then when the bank takes that, and they send you an email to confirm they got it, that's wire fraud. And here's the biggest one. This is really scary. Do you realize that when you get the check from the bank that's going to pay your loan, and you're going to send that money to your creditor, whoever's you're paying off your car, you're paying off your house, or whatever you're going to do, do you realize that when you make that deposit, you just committed money laundering? I've been in this business 35 years. I have no clue. Do you know how many people are in prison for what I just told you? I promise you, you do not know. I promise you, you don't know. And what's scarier than you not knowing is that the legislators, the U.S. congressmen and senators that write these laws, they don't know me. They have no clue. And I want to be real clear. Bad people that do bad things belong in prison. You commit a crime, you make a mistake, you should be held accountable. But I have to tell you, we have thousands upon thousands of people sitting in American prisons today that didn't need prison to pay for their mistake. And who's paying for it?
Taxpayer.
But you're not paying half. You're not paying a tenth of what you really think you're paying. And I'm going to explain why. How much do you think it costs to hold somebody in prison for a year? What do you say?
$20,000.
20? What do you say?
100?
80. 80? All right.
30.
30? 60. Okay. So we're between 20 and 100,000, okay? The United States Bureau of Prisons will tell you that it costs you, the American taxpayer, about $30,000 a year to house a federal prisoner. Okay. That number may be right for the BOP because they have 214,000 prisoners federally. All right? But I can promise you that is not what it costs you, the people in this room, to put me in prison. Why?
Justice system,
legal fees.
Opportunity cost.
Huh?
Opportunity cost.
What do you mean?
It means the cost of having a functional citizen, someone who's contributing out of our country.
Say it louder.
The opportunity cost is the cost of having a functional person not in our culture.
Remember before when I was telling you how much I made? Mm-hmm. I made a shitload of money. Mm-hmm. I was making a lot of money. Before I got indicted, I was making about $1.5 million a year. In fact, 2004, I made over $7 million a year. Okay. I was making a lot of money. The U.S. government put me in prison for 3 years. While I went to prison, I wasn't working. If I was making $1 million before I left, that's $300,000 I was paying in taxes, $350,000. And I can promise you, whatever I wasn't paying in taxes, her mother was spending in the economy. You lost $1 million a year at minimum for 3 years that I went to prison. Now I have to ask you, if I was Charles Manson, if I was some mass murderer, if I was some complete Reagan lunatic terrorist that wanted to create demise in the country, I can almost justify $1 million a year to hold somebody in prison. But it cost you $3 million to $5 million to have me sit in prison for 3 years and
twiddle my thumbs, read books, and exercise. Is it worth it? You know how many of me there are in the United States prison system today? Thousands. Thousands upon thousands of people that didn't need prison to pay for the mistakes. And who's paying for it? We are. So that's all I'm going to say about that. I just had to get that out. So now I want to go, I want to get into leadership in itself. What is the key to the success, the key to success?
I want to give everybody maybe a 5-minute rest and break.
Yeah, good. Okay. 5-minute break.
Thank you. Following lunch, I figured we were about it.
Okay. Run over to the restaurant and ask them if they can give me some. There's a restaurant over there. Some muscle or something like that.
Oh, sure.
Okay.
Yeah. Where's the bathroom? Oh, no, I know.
This room isn't too small. This room isn't too small.
Yeah, when I come back in, we'll do it. When they come in.
So I'd see about a month
as a group or with myself?
No, with you.
With me?
Yeah.
Gorgeous. I live in New York City. We used to
go. Media photographer.
Justice for War Review.
Mm-hmm.
When the Free the Jane.
Mm-hmm.
Where did you find that?
You speak Korean very well.
Huh?
You speak Korean very well.
No. I used to a long time ago. I have a Korean daughter.
Wow.
I have a daughter from Korea.
We're in Indiana.
We're on the state line of Indiana and Illinois. Okay. We're about 75 miles west of Indianapolis.
Yeah, we travel there through there every year. Married my wife's parents live in.
It doesn't make any difference in the period. I will write the check back.
Yeah, I'm supposed to get there. Back before they built all the other ones.
Yeah.
Something like 40 or whatever.
First time I ever went to Florida, no interstates. We had to,
yeah.
We drove straight down 41.
The good news, at least you get something to eat.
Thank you, sir.
You're welcome.
Steve,
is that okay?
That's perfect.
Yeah, perfect.
50 miles an hour, 20 miles an hour, 50 miles
right,
an hour,
right,
20
right.
miles an hour.
It'll take you 2 days to get, or 3 days to get down.
Thank you.
you've really had some luck.
It's been a long ride.
It's not over.
But you know, I
that's what's scary.
I would think that, other than maybe the handy business, you really don't regret that.
And I got to be honest, now that I look, not that I like any of the tools I work on, but in one strange way, I'm happy I got to see what I did, because you can't, and this goes to leadership in itself, you can't change something.
You wouldn't
you
know
it. Right?
You can't fix it if you don't know the problem. There's always a reason for everything. They say there's always a reason for everything.
Yeah, true.
How was that wrapped?
Tiny, tiny.
The portion is out now.
I want to
We're still recording on here.
Did you restart it?
No, we're still recording.
Okay.
Something if you do not know it's broken. Alright? You all believe in that? Alright. In 1990, there were 2,640 homicides in New York City. New York City had a violence rate, murder rate, probably greater than Baghdad during the war. It was a really, really bad place. In 1994, Giuliani came in and took over. And when he came in and took over, he appointed Bill Bratton as the police commissioner. Same guy that's there today in New York City. Bill Bratton had a guy with him. His name was Jack Maple. And Jack Maple had an idea. And his idea came from a book called Reinventing Government. Anybody read the book? You know what it is? You know what it is.
I knew you would know this. Reinventing Government was a book written by a guy named David Oswald.
If you're a business owner, if you're a manager, if you're somebody that has people that has to report to you, if you're somebody that has a need, you have an absolute need for accountability,
then you need to read that book. Because the premise of the book is exactly what you just said. You cannot fix a problem that you do not know exists. And that was the problem in New York City. In New York City, we did things just like everybody else did at the time, including in business. Historically, businesses, government agencies, especially government agencies, because the less work you do, the better. In business and government agencies, historically, we collected data yearly or biannually. And we would look at that data to see what our problems are. Well, I have to tell you, if you're looking at crime and crime trends every 6 months, guess what? You're about 5 months and 3.5 weeks behind the times. If you're looking at crime trends every 3 months, you're 2.5 months behind the times. If you're looking at crime trends every month, you're still about 3 weeks behind the times, because things will change daily. If you run Walmart or Home Depot or Walgreens or one of these other crazy enormous stores, and you're looking at your sales and what you're accomplishing and what you're doing, if you're looking at it quarterly, you're way behind the times. So here's what happened in the New York City Police Department. And not only in the NYPD, but at Rikers Island. When I ran Rikers, the statistical sort of catastrophes of New York City, Rikers was probably even worse than the city in itself. We averaged 150 stabbings and slashings per month. We had the most violent jail system in the nation at the time. And when I came in, I started to collect the data on violence. But I didn't collect it quarterly. I didn't look at it monthly. I looked at it every single day. When I got in my car in the morning, there was a folder that sat on the seat next to me in the back of the car, and I would pick up that folder and I would look at it. And all of the violence statistics from the day before, the last 24 hours, ending at 6 a.m., was sitting on that seat. So I would pick up that folder and I would look at it, and I would know exactly what happened yesterday in each facility. What does that give you the ability to do?
Maneuver. Hone in on the problem exactly where it came from.
Say again?
Hone in on the problem exactly where it came from.
Okay, and?
Maneuver quickly.
Maneuver quickly, and?
Address something that's all.
Take action.
Take action. Accountability. And I'll give you some quick insights. When I took over Rikers, I remember I was walking past the visiting center one time, and I saw an attorney that I knew from my days as a cop. He was a Spanish guy from up in the Bronx, great attorney. I locked up these guys for drugs. He was the attorney for the suspect. And he was just a great guy. I see him all the time in court. So I'm walking by the visit center one day, and I see him sitting in there, and I say, "Hey, what's up?" So I go up and talk to him, and he says, "Yeah, Mike, I got a guy, I got a client, I'm, you know." So we're talking, and as I'm talking to him, I realize this guy's been sitting waiting for his client, who's an inmate, who's up in my control. He's been waiting for him for 5.5 hours, sitting in the room. This is an attorney now. Now, I don't know about that guy. I know what I paid for my attorneys. I'm sure that guy wasn't paying that. But anyway, whatever he was paying, he has an attorney sitting in the visit center for 5.5 hours. He hasn't seen him yet. So I called downstairs. I said, "What's the problem?" "Well, the inmate, we said a thing. We don't know. We're not sure. Maybe he's in the medical. Maybe he's in the thing. Is he in the building?" That's all I want to know. "Is he in the building?" "Yeah." "Okay. We know he's in the building, right? He's not in court?" "No." "Okay. Then why does it take 5.5 hours? Better yet, why does it take an hour? We know that guy's in this building. the building's like, it's not like a half a mile long. Like, why does it take more than an hour to get that guy to the visit room? Well, it's always been like this. Wrong answer. Anytime looks at you and says, especially when there's a problem, if there's a problem, and you say, you know, why'd you do this? And somebody looks at me and say, because that's the way we've always done it. I would say slap them, but don't slap them. But just say, okay, well, now we're going to do it again. Okay? Well, that was the answer. That was pretty much the answer. So now I'm gonna go back to the accountability. Whoever said that, you can take action. Here's what I did. I took a poster and I put it up in the visit center. And it was a big poster. It said to all attorneys, if you don't see your client within 45 minutes after you arrive in the visit center, you are to call this number. You know whose number that was?
Yours.
That wasn't mine. Don't get crazy.
That's all I need.
But it was my chief of staff. It was his cell number. Now, I'll show you how slick accountability is when it works. We only had two calls to that number. Two calls, and it never happened again.
And those two calls were really quick, and then it never happened again, right?
The attorney's there an hour and 10 minutes. He called John, he called my chief of staff. He said, listen, I'm in the Roseland Senior Center. It was a female jail. I've been in an hour and 10 minutes. My client's still not down. Okay. Now, as in any big organization, you know, if you're a security captain in a facility, you're about 16 ranks down the chain between me and him, okay, or her. Well, a security captain gets a call from the assistant deputy warden in charge of security, who got a call from the security deputy warden, who got a call from the warden, who got a call from the bureau chief, who got a call from the chief of department, who got a call from the first deputy, who got a call from my chief of staff. That is not a good thing, because by the time that captain got that call, I promise you, there were people running all over that building looking for that inmate. It happened two times. On the second time it happened, just so happened to be the day that we were having what we called the teams meeting. We created an accountability concept. There are two pretty famous accountability concepts that came out of New York City under Rudy Giuliani. One was CompStat. CompStat stood for computer statistics, and it was basically the collection of crime statistics on a daily basis so that the police department could know what was happening, and how we could address it. The second concept came out of the Department of Correction. I created it. It was recognized by Harvard's Innovations in Government, John F. Kennedy School. Both of these programs were, as a matter of fact. The concept we created was teams. The concept for the NYP just focused on crime. I went far beyond violence in the New York City jail system. When we started teams, and it stood for Total Efficiency Accountability Management System, when I started that, we were just looking at violence. All I wanted to do was get the slashings and the stabbings down to eliminate the violence so that the staff and the inmates were safer, more secure. But then I realized something. I'm collecting violence stats on a daily basis, so I know where the stabbings were, where the fights were, who the problem child was, how we responded, where we responded, how many searches we did, how many weapons were seized. I would collect all that stuff on a daily basis. And immediately, I realized, wait a minute, as we start to reduce the numbers in violence, something else is happening. If the violence numbers comes down, and a guy that, and I'll explain this so you understand it, if there's a stabbing, if these two people stab each other in a prison, they're both going to the hospital. Okay? Now, well, first, you got to break them up. So you send a whole bunch of correctional officers to break up the fight. Okay? Now, they got stabbed, they're going to the hospital. Some of those correction officers that came to break up the fight, they're going to the hospital too for one of two reasons. One, they use more force than they should have and they're nervous about it. They want to make sure that their injuries are documented, or they really got hurt bad and they got to go. Except, when you take this guy to the hospital, he needs two COs to go with him. So you got to take two COs off post, and you got to pull them off their post, and you got to send them, and then you got to backfill those two posts with overtime. And then you got to get two more COs to take her, and they got to be backfilled on overtime too. And then you have to get escort officers to go with the officers, and you got to backfill those positions on overtime. Now, when you go into an emergency room, anybody from New York City here? Nobody? You're in New York State. Nobody from New York City.
We have British Columbia.
No, that's what we're saying. No, all over the world. It's not New York City. Okay. You go into a hospital in New York City in an emergency room, I promise you, I don't know what it's like where you go, but where we go, hey, it could be there for 4 days. Okay. Those people that went there are all on overtime. The people that are backfilling those positions, they're on overtime too. So now, you had some that got injured, some that got hurt, some is on overtime. What's that going to do?
Reinforces.
Huh?
Everything goes up.
Everything goes up. Well, what else goes up? Something you wouldn't even think of. And I was in the business a long time. I didn't think about it until I collected this data and got to see it for myself. What else goes up? Your sick rate. And not just the people that got injured. Because those guys that went with you to the hospital, what are they going to do tomorrow?
Take the day off.
Take the day off. I'm tired. I'm not going to work. So if they're going to take the day off, and guess what? What do you have to do? You got to backfill on
overtime.
Okay. You getting the gist now? So, violence led to additional staff, which led to overtime, which led to sick abuse, which led to overtime, which led to sick abuse. We had the highest violence sick rate in the United States. The average sick rate for a correctional officer in New York City was 22 and a half days a year. That was average. I had 13,000 people in the agency. You know what the city pays for? 12. You know what it costs for every day over 12? $1.6 million for every day over 12. That's your rate. Okay? So, being the innovative kind of guy that I am, I went to the mayor and I said, listen, I need a bunch of equipment for the emergency service unit who responds to violence. I need like $4 million. No, we don't have the money. So look, I said, okay, our sick rate is 22 days a year. We're authorized 12. If I get the sick rate down to 19, anything I get under 19, could I have that money? It's 1.6 million a year. He said, no, but if you get it under 18, I'll give you anything under 18. You know what I got it to? 12 and a half. I got it to 12 and a half. So for the next several years, I took $4 and $5 million a year out of my budget to buy all the emergency service guys, all the extra equipment they need. What's that do? Besides enhanced security.
Increase morale.
That's say it loud.
Raise morale.
It increases morale. If I ask you to do a job, what do I have to do in order for you to do that job?
Support you.
Say it loud.
Support you.
Support you. How do I support you?
Give you the tools for success.
Say it loud.
Give you the tools for success.
Give you the tools to do your job. You ask somebody to do a job for you, if I ask you to do a job for me, but I turn around and say, listen, You know, yeah, I hear what you're saying, but I can't do that. All right. You want me to do the job, or you don't want me to do the job? If you want me to do the job, this is what I need. Right? Now, if I ask you to do a job, and you say, this is what I need, and I give you what you need, and you don't do that job, what happens?
You get crushed. Hold them accountable.
No excuse.
Huh? Hold them accountable.
Hold them accountable.
You've got to hire somebody else to do it right.
That's my way of thinking. Okay. I don't know about you guys. All right. I'm not a bad guy. I'm a very realistic guy. I think I have pretty good instincts. I call you in to do a job. What do you need to do this? I then give you what you said. You said. I didn't say. You said. I ask you what you need. This is what I need. Okay, here you go. Okay, I give you exactly what you need. And then you don't succeed. That's not my fault. That's your fault. In my book, you got to go. And then I go to the guy next to you, or under you, or around you, or I find one somewhere on the street, and I bring them in, and I say, look, here's what I need done. What happens? What do I need? What do you need? And guess what? Here's what usually happens, especially in a big agency. I ask you to do a job. You don't do the job. You got to go. I promise you, that guy, he's going to do the job. Okay, what is the most substantial motivator in leadership and accountability?
Death.
There you go. That's a little extreme.
Using that from the art of war.
Unless, right. I was just going to say, in the art of war, or maybe under Saddam's regime. But other than that, okay.
Recognition and knowing that you care.
Okay, that's second. Money is second and third.
Responsibility
comes with that.
Ownership
comes with that. Fear. Fear is a motivator. Fear is an enormous motivator. Why?
Raises awareness.
What else is doing? You have a job, right? I pay you, right? I'm paid. You have a job. You're making good money. I want you to do that job. I'll give you a job. You don't do that job, what happens?
You're fired.
You have a family? You have kids? You got to take care of your family? All right. What is the motivator more than anything else?
Fear.
Now, some people look at me and go, oh, that's terrible. You threaten a guy? I'm not threatening anybody. I have a job to do, too. Fear is a motivator. You work for Rudy Giuliani, you don't succeed, I promise you, you will be fired. You will have to go. It's not like they say in The Godfather. Is that personal? It's business. And it's true. It's business. In business, it's not personal. So, that is a motivator. Now, for the rank and file, what are motivators? Now, a lot of you guys, you run your own schools, right? Or you may work for somebody, you may work under somebody that owns their own schools, okay? You're going to have people that work for you. The people on the bottom, they are the most important part of your stuff, whatever your stuff is, whether it's karate schools or Walmart. People on the bottom are extremely important. Why?
To work.
Because they're the ones that accomplish. Because they're the ones that make you what?
Money.
They make you look good. Especially if you're not the big boss or you're under the big boss, you want to what? You want to look good, right? You want to succeed. You need to make sure you succeed. In other words, in order for you to succeed, that means those guys on the bottom, they got to succeed. They got to do the right job. All right? What motivates them besides fear?
Recognition.
Money is recognition, right? A pat on the back is recognition. Public acknowledgement is recognition. There's a number of things that you can do to inspire, motivate, entice people that work for you to succeed. You need to make sure you do that. And with the same vein as doing that, you need to make sure that those people are then held accountable to do what they're supposed to do. You should collect data, collect information on whatever it is you're doing, whether it's karate school, whether it's whatever. You need to collect information. And you use that information to determine whether you are what? It's two things. Well, you're either going to succeed or you're going to fail. That's what you're looking for. You're looking for those two things. You're collecting data to determine whether you succeed or fail. If you are failing, what do you do with the data? You then use it to what?
Find out where you're not at all.
To find out where, what, how, why, and what has to be done. Okay? If you're succeeding, what do you do?
More of it.
Say again?
Do more of it.
You're going to do more of it, but what do you do that people, like, a lot of times they just completely, like, they miss the boat. They don't even think of this. And I'll tell you why CompStat and Teams, why this was so important. And let me just tell you what CompStat and Teams was. Every week, we held the CompStat and Teams meeting. In that meeting, remember I told you about the command staff meetings that we had with everybody in the room? Well, at a CompStat meeting, every executive officer of the NYPD is in that room. Every chief, every executive chief, and every deputy commissioner, assistant commissioner, they're all in that room. You know why they're in that room? I'm going to tell you, I'll give you some real-time examples. This one comes from correction. I just think it's kind of funny. I had a warden of a facility. We were looking at his overtime, and we determined that he had maintenance guys that had to have a key made. A key to a certain part of the building, he had to have it made. And it wound up costing like $700 in overtime to have a key made. And I wanted to know why. Why did it cost $700 in overtime for that guy? How's that happen? Explain to me how that happened. So we're having this discussion. And during the course of this discussion, I come to find out that the electrical guys and the maintenance guys, like, they got a whole racket going. Because if you call them out and it's more than like 4 hours, if it's more than an hour, they get paid for four, and it's on double time and a half on a Sunday, and it's a whole big... It's New York City. It's a union. So it's like a whole thing. You know, I get this whole thing going. So anyway, during the course of this, now I got everybody in the agency sitting in this room. And I want to know why. Tell me why. Tell me what happened. So who do I ask? I ask the warden. Warden can't tell me. I ask the deputy warden. He's standing right next to me. He can't tell me. Okay. Who's the bureau chief that runs that side of the island? You are? Okay. I want you to tell me. I don't know. You don't know? Who's the bureau chief? You're his boss? Okay, you tell me. I don't know. Well, I went right up the chain of command until I got to the chief of department, who's sitting two things away from me. Can anybody tell me why? No. Okay. I want to see the, I forget what they're called, for every maintenance thing you do in any government agency, you have to make a formal request because it has to be tracked. I want to see the request that was made for the key. Oh, we don't have it with us. Oh, you don't have it with us? Okay. Well, in this CompStat room, we had six fax machines right here. Six fax machines. We had all these monitors, and on those monitors, I could tap into the warden's office. The warden's sitting in the room with me, but I could tap into his office and say hello to his assistant and say, hey, we're over here, you're over there, he needs that document, put it up on that screen right now. Oh, we don't have it. Well, you don't have it. Didn't you just tell me that you did this personally? Yeah. Okay, show it to me. Show it to me. Somebody show it to me. What am I doing?
What am I doing? Say it. Who said that? You're holding them accountable. And it's in what?
Real time.
Real time. That's what it is. Real time accountability. Real time accountability. That's what you want. And why do you want real time accountability? For two reasons. One, you need to figure out what the problem is and you need to fix it. But two, or more importantly, how many people are sitting in that room? Every boss in that agency is in that room. Every single boss in that agency is in that room. And what don't they want? They don't want to be the guy next week that's sitting up at that podium, you saying, hey, dude, let me see that piece of paper. Or let me see that document. Or let me see that key. Or let me see whatever. Because here's what can happen. And this is, well, I'm going to tell you, this is an actual scenario. I had inspections in one facility, and it was atrocious. And I sent word back to the facility that I wanted this thing, this stuff, cleaned up. And that warden came to the next team's meeting and stood up at the podium with two deputy wardens while we were actually in the room. While we were there, I had a team. I had my inspection team from the commissioner's office in that facility. While I'm talking to this guy, they're there, and I'm saying, how is the intake area? Intake area has been all cleaned up. Okay, push a button, look up the screen. Didn't you just tell me it was all cleaned up? It was painted, right? You said it was painted? John, is that, are you in the wrong place? No, sir, I'm in the right place. It has not been painted. Hasn't been painted. Okay, and what about this? And I went through four or five scenarios. And I said, okay, time out. Now, we have 150 people in this room. And this is a true scenario, what I'm telling you. The fire commissioner, Tom Van Essen, was the fire commissioner of the New York City Fire Department. He was visiting my agency, sitting on the dais with me on this morning. So I said, okay, time out. We'll take a break. Everybody take a 10-minute break. I go in the back of my office. I get my chief of staff. I said, call the chief of the department, bring him in. Calls the chief in. I said, okay, relieve the warden of his command. Send him down to personnel right now. He's retiring today. Get the two deputy wardens, transfer them, pull so-and-so and so-and-so out of these two facilities, put them in there temporarily, and find me a warden that's going to get this mess clean. And off they went. And Tom Von Essen, the fire commissioner, is sitting there, and we're having a conversation, and we go back out. And we sit down, except this time we sat down on the right side of the room where that warden, the three deputy wardens, and all of his security captains were sitting. It was empty. There were nobody in those seats. And we went on with the meeting. And I did the other two facilities, and we finished, and everybody went about their business. So the next morning, I go to my executive staff meeting in City Hall with the mayor. And the mayor said, Giuliani says to Tom Van Essen, he says, hey, Tom, you went out to Rikers yesterday? He said, yes, sir. He said, what'd you think? He says, well, I'll tell you one thing. He said, it sent a hell of a message. You come back from a 10-minute meeting, there's a bunch of empty chairs and Now, what does that do? It inspires, it motivates, it holds people accountable, and it sends a very clear message to your command staff, do your job or else. It's not personal.
one of those guys. I love the guy. It's business. Business is money. You have to hold the people accountable. You have to make sure they're doing their job. You have to reward them. You have to motivate them. You have to inspire them. You have to take care of them. But sometimes it just doesn't go the way it's supposed to, and they gotta go. With that, I probably talked way too much. Steve, give me what do you, what else? Anything I haven't covered?
Well, most everybody's case here, in order to execute what you just said, they end up with two variables that oftentimes they haven't thought through in advance. Number one, they end up with a lack of instrument. And so certainly addressing how to develop quality people that are there to come in as you're weeding out the bad ones. Number two is so many of their staff were students of theirs, and they get emotionally engaged in overlooking their weaknesses. How do you get around that?
All right. We'll go back to the first one in a minute, but the second one is more important to me because it's stuff that I've... Did everybody hear what you just said? Okay. This is personal, this is real, what I'm going to tell you. I told you some of my background when I was a cop, okay? I was an extremely aggressive cop, both in uniform patrol and in plain clothes. I was very aggressive. The guys that worked with me, the guys that I enjoyed working with at least, they were very aggressive too, because you work with and play with the people that are like you. So the guys that were with me were very aggressive guys. Gun battles, shootouts, chases, all that cop stuff you see on TV, we've done 1,000 times. But then, I became police commissioner. Okay? And on the morning I became police commissioner, I was called to a press conference. It was a Saturday morning, and I stand up in this big room in City Hall where the mayor of New York City announces to the whole world, and I say the whole world because I was a bit embarrassed when the London Times ran a headline, high school dropout becomes New York City's police commissioner. But at the end of the day, I'm the police commissioner, so I don't give a shit. But the reality is, I'm now the police commissioner. And in that audience are a bunch of New York City detectives with medals up to their ears that were my partners, one of which was shot in a gun battle, and I shot the guy that shot him. You want to talk close? We were close. And we were so close and so tight that on the morning of September 11th, when that second plane slammed through that building, we were running down the block, that guy that got shot 12 years earlier, and that I shot the guy that shot him, he is actually the guy that drug me up the block and gave me a serious wedgie as he was doing it, running me down the street. He was my principal bodyguard. Okay. I stepped off the steps after I was announced by the mayor, and I looked at him, and I said, "Where do you work?" He says, "I'm in the intelligence division, my bodyguard for a judge." And I can remember this. I was in correction. I was the correction commissioner. I ran Rikers, so I don't know all the protocols for the NYPD. And I turned around to one of my chiefs, and I said, If I want to get Hector Santiago transferred to me, how do we do that? He goes, "You're transferred." I said, "That's it?" He says, "What do you want? You want to transfer or not?" I said, "Yeah." He says, "All right, you're done with him." I said, "Yeah, but he's working. He works for, like, he's in the intelligence division." "All right, we'll do it. Transfer. Go. Yeah, let's go." So I walked around Rome, and I went and I picked, you know, Bobby Picciano was a patrolman in emergency service, two gun battles, shot three times. I see him in the audience. "Bobby, you want to work for me?" You, let's go. And I pulled him on the side, and that was it. Now they're working for me, okay? But one, keep in mind that these guys knew me. They know me. They know what I'm like. They also knew and recognized immediately. Now, keep this in mind. There's an enormous amount of protocol. It's like this building.
It's like this reservation, enormous protocol here, military protocol, when the NYPD immediately, for Hector Santiago, who's like my brother, who's like my brother, Scott, I saved his life. We've been in shootings together. We've done some crazy things together. Booming doors, drug cartels, all the jungles, all this stuff. It went from, hey, burn, to sir and commissioner. Immediate, boom. To this day, he is my best friend. He's my best friend. He calls me 5 times a week. And he's got a hell of a job. He retired from the NYPD. He is the principal bodyguard for the chairman of Time Warner. He flies all over the world with Jeff Bukas, who is the chairman. And he is his principal security. But he will call me 5 times a week. And the difference between him and I is when he's calling me, when I call him, I'm in New Jersey. When he calls me, he's at the Cannes Film Festival. He's at the Golden Globes. He's at the Grammy Award things. He's at, you know, it's Monaco, something. He's in Hong Kong. Where, every time he calls, he's somewhere else. But to this day, it's commissioned. To this day, there is a protocol that he understands, knows, and has accepted. You're going to have people that you've worked with and then become employees of yours. You know, in the government arena, and keep this in mind, now, when I went to the police, when I went to the correction department, I left as a detective. I was gone for 6.5 years. When I came back to the NYPD, I came back as commissioner. You know what that did? That put about 54,900 people that I worked for or I was under, I'm now their boss.
Now they're
what? Huh?
Now they're...
I'm their boss. Oh. So, all those guys, and believe me, there are people, you know, I can remember captains and above. I had 400 commanders, captains and above. I can remember there were guys that said, I'm not working for Delta Tech. Okay. Well, guess what? Time to retire. Gotta go. I ain't got an issue. I'm going to be here. It doesn't matter to me. If you're going to do what I say, if you don't do what I say, you gotta go. So, and I told them that. In fact, big article on pay. You know, I get up there and I give this speech. We're going to do this. We're going to do that. Three things. It's very simple. We're going to reduce crime. We're going to fix community relations. And we're going to enhance morale and take care of cops. That's what we're going to do. If you're with me, we're good. If you're not with me, you got to go. And I'm walking off the stage, and I said, oh, one last thing. I said, I've heard some of those things floating around. There are people in this room. You're not going to work for a third-grade detective. I said, I strongly urge you get over real quick, like within the next 10 minutes. And I walked off the stage. Don't you know one of those slime balls went to the press and told them? There's a big thing in the newspapers. Then I finally figured out who it was, and they went anyway. So, at the end of the day, you're going to have relationships with people that you've come up the ranks with, and then who work for you. That's personal. Business is business. They have to understand it. You have to understand it. They have to be held accountable. And, you know, sometimes the lines get blurred. You just have to make sure that the line is clear. And what was the first thing you said?
Building bench strength is, you know, in a small business, it's difficult to have the chutzpah to get rid of somebody who's not performing if you don't have bench strength behind them. A story that I like, I was talking to Carl Mecklenburg, who was a Super Bowl athlete, Bronco, and his comment was, he said, I'm coaching high school football and it's so much different than what I was ever used to. And I asked him, it was a long story, but ultimately what was the difference? He said, well, in the pros, you go in after the game, watch the film, the coach yells at you. It's not like you have to support because you're all motivated. And I said, well, what was the difference? He goes, well, there's a long line of people who want your spot right behind you. So if you don't do your job, it's the next guy up. And I'd say most of the schools in the room here don't have the next guy up. Yeah. They have it pre-planned for that succession.
And that, the only thing I could say, the the thing that stands out in my mind, you have to make sure that the people you move up are the people you think can do the job. I mean, unless you're just in dire straits and you have to make, and you have to have a substitute, or you have to have, you know, in a government agency, especially when you have a lot of people like I did, you know, it's like a bus. I used to tell the guys, listen, it's like a bus. You miss this one, you catch the next one. That's what it's going to be like. In a smaller arena, you don't have that ability. So if you don't have that ability, you have to be extremely careful to make sure that the people you do move up are the people that's deserving. And I think if you groom them right, if you motivate them, you inspire them right, you'll be a lot better off. And that's in a small arena, that's going to be extremely important.
One of the things, I don't know if I'm going to say it's trouble or it's maybe growing pains or maybe it's my pain, but my younger instructors, among them that you even met, Mr. Oliver, actually are listening to me like as all of you are speaking of, they'll do everything you want. The older instructors, which I know you've probably heard before, are the ones that have a difficult time adjusting their ways because it was the old way, it's not the new way, and it's a new way now, it's all this stuff, you know. And with that said, they're not hurting my business majorly, but they're holding me back, they're slowing me down. I believe I can get them to adjust, but it's taking a heck of a lot of work, okay? And that's basically where I stand with that, you know. They're not like, well, maybe I need to put them on the spot, like you say. Put them right on the spot and say, this is what I need done. This is when I need it done. And if you can't get it done, we need to go down, okay?
But I think one of the things you could look at doing, first of all, try not to keep separation in the people who work for you. It's, and I'm going to be very careful on the way I say this. Never, ever, ever, if you learn anything from me today, don't verbally attack, don't verbally abuse, don't embarrass, don't do any of that stuff publicly or in front of your other managers, your other students. Never do that. Okay. First of all, just a personal issue. It's just inappropriate. It's wrong. Okay. You're an ass if you do that. Okay? You don't need to do that. All right? So that's number one. Number two, there's ways to talk to people. You shouldn't talk to anybody the way you wouldn't want somebody talking to you. Okay? That's the way you talk to people. Now, all that being said, it's much better, in my opinion, that you have all the teachers, all the instructors, in one place at one time. This is the mission. This is what... And I want to. This is basic leadership, basic innovations in government, basic David Gergen and David Osborne and all those guys that have studied this stuff for years. This is basic stuff. You have a mission statement for your school. You create goals and objectives to hit that mission statement, and then you're going to create performance measures to make sure that you hit your goals and objectives. Okay? Well, that's the same. No matter which one of those instructors you're talking to, they should all know what those goals and objectives are, and they should all know the performance measures and indicators to hit them. And they don't have to be separate and apart for you to tell them. And you need to tell them, one, this is what we're going to do. This is what I need you to do. Is there anybody in this room that don't think they can do it? Anybody in this room that disagrees? Tell me what the disagreement is. Tell me what you think. Tell me how. Tell me why. Two things. One, listen to them. And listen to them because you may get something you didn't expect. Two, you then tell them what they're going to do. You know, I used to tell my guys, in this arena where I work, I run shit. I run. This ain't a democracy. This is a dictatorship here. I won. Now, you can tell me what you think. You can recommend. You can do whatever. You can do all that stuff. I want you to do that. But at some point in time, I'm going to say, okay, hold up. I heard enough. Here's what we're doing. A, B, C, D. Now, at that point, I'm not asking no more. Now we're doing it.
I
made the final decision, and you're going to do it. And listen,
and you did it referencing what they're speaking of as well.
And exactly. Now I'm going to take something back one time. Remember I talked about motivation, enhancements, motivation, inspiring. And you might get something out of this. I had an enormous agency, both agencies. Every 3 or 4 weeks on a Friday afternoon, when I ran correction or I ran the PD, my chief of staff would call a borough command. And he would say, when we ran Rikers, he would call up the Rikers, and he'd say, listen, he'd have all the rosters for the jails. And he'd say, listen, call this jail right now. Take the officer on this post, and this post, and send them over to the commissioner's office right now. He doesn't know who they are. He just knows that those posts are working posts. Those are security posts. Which means whoever's working those posts, they know the job. Because they wouldn't really be on those posts if they didn't know the job. He would do that in all 10 jails. It's on records. And within a half hour, I'd have 30 people sitting in a room. I've never seen it before. I've never seen them, and I can promise you the only time they've seen me is on TV. Especially in the NYPD. You got 55,000. The only time they see you is if it's TV or the day they get sworn in. That's it. They're never going to see you again unless they're in real, real, real bad trouble. And they don't want to see you anyway at that point. So now I got 30 people sitting in a room that I know are really ingrained workers. They know the job because those are serious posts they just came from. And I would walk in, and I'd say hi. And after the stunning shock of seeing me being there, and before I got in there, we'd have food. My chief of staff would buy pizzas and sandwiches and all this stuff. So he would walk in, and he'd say, listen, commissioner wants to talk to you guys. He's going to be in here in about 20 minutes. In the meantime, there's a bunch of food, sodas, and stuff. Just take off your gum belts, relax, have dinner. He's going to be in about 20 minutes. The first 5 minutes, if you had a camera, they're in there like this. They're like looking around. Like looking around. They're trying to figure out what the hell am I doing here? What is this? Then they eat their food and I walk in. How you doing? I walk around the table. I shake everybody's hand. Sit down. I take out my wallet. And in my wallet, I have my shield. I say, okay, listen up. You just got a call from Mayor Giuliani. He called you to City Hall, he handed you the shield, and he gave you my job. I want to know 3 things from you right now. What would you do to enhance morale? What would you do to make your job more safe and secure? And what would you do to save the city money? What's most important to me? Enhance morale. Security and money, right? Well, who am I asking? I'm asking the guys on the bottom. You know what? They're going to tell me. You know why they're going to tell me? Because there ain't none of their bosses in that room. So they're going to talk to me.
Sir, what was the third one again?
Money. What would you do to enhance morale? What would you do to make it more safe and secure? What would you do to save the city money? And guess what? I had 30 guys in that room. 30% of them were complete morons. Morons. When I tell you morons, morons. Tell me the stupidest, craziest nonsense I've ever heard. 30%, you know, could go either way, maybe a little better. Okay? 30%, 40%. They would tell me things that I would sit there and go, oh my God, I never thought of that. I didn't know that. I couldn't do that. And what am I going to do? When I hear something real good, what am I going to do? I'm going to do what he said. And I'll give you some really slick examples. One time, I had cops in from the NYPD. I had a bunch of cops, about 25 cops in the room. And a cop looks at me and he says, commissioner. He says, I just got one thing. I said, what is it? He reaches in his back pocket. He pulls out his radio. He says, you see the radio? I said, yeah. He said, how much is this worth? something like $3,000. He said, right, you see where it is? It's in my back pocket. He said, you see my pocket's all ripped? You know why it's ripped? Because I put this radio in it all the time. I said, yeah. He said, the radio's worth $3,000. I said, yeah. He said, if I drop the radio and I break the radio, who pays for it? I said, you do. He said, right. He said, do you know there's about 10,000 radio cases at the quartermaster's that we don't have? I said, what are you talking about? He says, we don't get radio cases. He said, but there's 10,000 of them sitting at quartermaster's down in Brooklyn that they just won't put in the commands. I said, why? He said, I don't know. I'm asking, why do I carry this thing in my back pocket? He said, why are you going to charge me $3,000 when there's a radio case that we're supposed to have that's in the quartermaster's? I said, well, I'll tell you what, we're going to find out. And I turn around, and my chief of staff had already left the room. And before those cops, that guy was from the Bronx, before he got back to the Bronx, they were delivering radio cases to every command. I got a call from the PBA president, who runs, he has 40,000 members. I got a call next morning and says, let me ask you a question. Did you actually have cops down there that told you about the radio case you delivered in every prison? I said, yeah. That's crazy. What'd they do? What did they do?
Enhanced morale.
Because I did what they asked. Was it a big thing? No. Did it cost me any money? No, it didn't cost me no money.
It
saved me. It's a good thing.
It saved money because they didn't break the radios.
And it saves them. All right? So that's one thing. Now, you talk about enhanced morale. This will show you about enhanced morale. It'll also give you some insight as to how completely insane I am. I had a cop that worked for me. His name was Joe Vigiano. He was in the emergency service here. This is a true story. What I'm telling you is a true story. He was in emergency service. Emergency service is like the SWAT team from New York. He volunteered to be in emergency service after he had been involved in two different gun battles, one in 1994 and one in 1997. The first gun battle, he got shot 3 times, once in the chest. Second gun battle, he got shot 2 times, once in the chest. Then he volunteered to go to ESU, which is it's the craziest job in the world because of all the stuff they do. But I called him downtown to my office. I was going to promote him. And when he was in my office, he looked up at the wall, and he saw a photo of me rappelling off of some building when I was a young guy. And he said, hey, boss, is that you? That's you rappelling right there? I said, yeah. He says, you know, every Saturday, we go up on the Brooklyn Bridge, and we climb up there, and we rappel, and we have breakfast and stuff. I said, yeah. He said, you should come up there on Saturday with us. I said, wait. He said, up the bridge, you should walk up with us. He said, we'll go up and have breakfast. I said, why would I walk up on the Brooklyn Bridge? He said, because you. He said, that's what you used to do, right? I said, yeah. He said, you know, we guys, every police commissioner for like the last 5 PCs. That's all we got to tell. I was like, okay, let me think about it. Well, 2 weeks later on a Saturday, I put BDUs on, you know, utility clothes, and I put on a rig. And I went down and I met him, and I went up to the Brooklyn Bridge. Now, you have to understand, I don't know if you've ever seen the Brooklyn Bridge or pictures, it's big, it's real big. And to get from the bottom to the top, there's a round pole, it's about this round. It's about that round. It's small. And that pole goes up like that to the top of the bridge. Well, basically, you get on that pole, and you walk like this. You walk like that. All the way up to the top of the Brooklyn Bridge. And the only thing you have to hold on to are these 2 wire cables. That you put D-rings on them. But you basically walk. When I say walk, you walk up the bridge. Now, there's 2 funny parts to this. One is you have to come down. Going up is one thing, because you're looking up, you don't see nothing. Coming down, you're looking down. Not good. But the funnier thing is when you get up there, actually. Now, Joe said, when we get up there, he said, we have breakfast up there. Now, I thought he was joking. So we get to the top of the Brooklyn Bridge.
We are physically on the top. When you look at the Brooklyn Bridge, now I know everybody's going to go back to your room tonight and Google this shit. You'll see on the top of the Brooklyn Bridge, there's a flagpole with U.S. flags on the top of the bridge. When I got up to the top of that thing, there were COs, there were cops up there from emergency service. They had bagels, they had eggs, they had coffee, juice. And I started laughing. I said, I thought you were joking about the breakfast. He said, no. He says, we flip a coin. The guy that loses has to carry all that shit up there. He says, so we come up and have breakfast. And then we train, and they hang off the bridge, and they do all this completely insane stuff. And these are the guys that, when you hear there's a jumper on the George Washington Bridge, these are the maniacs that got to go get that guy. All right? The bad part of this story. Joe Vigiano died on September 11th.
But he was a great guy. Really good guy.
I forgot what I was saying. So you do... Oh, inspiration. I go up the bridge. I come down. I didn't get... My chief of staff got... I'll bet you he got 30 calls from PBA delegates, from union delegates all over the city. Is it true the PC went up on the Brooklyn Bridge with USC? Yeah. What did I do? And I want you to think about this, and I'll end with this because this is extremely important.
This is one of the most important things of leadership, I think. What did I do?
He's a role model. Gained respect.
Got
out of their level. He was a role
model. All right. It's all of the above.
Yeah. You did what you would ask them to do.
That's in a nutshell, that's it. You can't inspire somebody to do something that they do not think you would do yourself. Okay? You can't do that. So, there is not, in these cops, and that's why I had an enormous amount of respect in the NYPD and correction. I was a CO. I was a correctional, so I was a warden. And I was a cop, and I was a detective. And I knew their job really well. I did it really well. I was highly decorated. And they all knew there was nothing that I would ask them to do that I haven't already done. So, with that, if you have any questions. Said what we talked about earlier. You can't fix something you don't know exists. You don't know it's broken. You collect that data to make determinations on what's working, what's not. Oh, I know what it was.
Okay.
You have all those people in a room. You have all, and this goes to you, you have all your instructors. Okay? And you're looking at the data. You're looking at success and failure. Okay? The failure, you're going to address immediately. But the success, what are you going
to
do?
Reward them.
You're going to reward them. But you're going to use their success to incite, you're going to use their success to motivate, and you're going to use their success to make the others do it.
And I'll give you one example. I have, in a facility at Rikers, I have a major gang problem. Big gang problem. A lot of violence, a lot of stabbing, slashing, stuff going on. And I call in the warden. I said, listen, you got a week. Next contact, you're coming back in a week. If you don't have the violence down in this week, we're going to have an issue. I ain't going to have an issue. You're going to have an issue. Violence has to come down. You've got to stop it. Yes, sir. Boom. Out the door he goes. Overnight, like within 4 days, I'm looking at the stats daily, and I send a team over, and I said, I think this guy's good. Like, this shit's completely disappeared. I don't know what happened. It's like he's fudging the numbers or something. Get over there and find out what's going on. They come back and they sit down. He ain't fudging the numbers. They said, wait till it comes back. So I called him in. Comes up to things. I said, all right, Bill, you went from this number to this number, from this violence to that violence. You've completely whacked it, knocked it off the charts. What are you doing? He says, I changed my tours to midnights. Now, this is the warden. This is the warden. He went from coming in like 8 to 4 in the daytime. He went from that to 11 at night to 7 in the morning. And here's what he did. He put up a board like this, and he identified all the gang members in the facility. And every night, between 12 a.m. and 5 a.m., he went to every one of those gang leaders, and he woke them up. And he woke them up, and he picked up their locker, and he went through their locker, and he would take their commissary slip, and their commissary slip said, they bought 2 packs of cigarettes, they bought 5 Snickers bars, they bought this, they bought that. Well, that's what this guy owns. That's what he should have in his possession. Now, what's he have? He has 92 Snickers bars. Oh, he only has 4. Okay, take the rest. He has this one with this. How many has he got? 25. All right, well, take 24. And this, he did it every single night to every one of those guys. Because what do? When they go out and cut somebody, or extort, or rob, or whatever they do, they take their stuff. Okay? How many pairs of sneakers is he supposed to have? One. One. He's got 6. Take them all. Boom. Gone. And now, during the process, he may have collected some of this stuff on his own. He may have saved some of the stuff on his own. It may really be his. Too late. You have become a target because you are doing all this violence. It took 3 days. The 4th day, he came in at night. All the gang guys had all their stuff laid out under their bed, and they're all sitting on the bed waiting for him. He walks in, says, hey guys, how you doing? Good. Finally, the 4th night, the head of this group, they basically stood up and said, hey Ward, listen, man. All right, we quit. First of all, you screwed up our sleep. We ain't getting no damn sleep. You wake everybody up. You're messing up our nights. We ain't getting our visits. You can't get on the phone in the daytime. You're messing us all up here. He said, I can't have the violence. All right, boom. Now, that's what he did. What did I do? What did I do? I called every warden. I called all 16 wardens. I had to come down to the city, down to headquarters. I called all the wardens, and I put them in the room. And I put up on the board all his stats from 2 weeks ago. And I put all the stats today. And I said, I want you guys to listen to this. And I had him go through all the stuff he did. Right? Everything he did. And I said, you get it? He said, yeah. I says, all right. Everybody understand? Yeah. Got it. I said, okay, good. Any questions? No, sir. All right, we're done. I turned around. I said, oh, hold up 1 second. I reached over on the other side of the desk. I said, Billy, do me a favor. Take that shield off. Now, he's a warden. 1 second. He's like, excuse me? I said, take that shield off. I said, put this on. I handed him a 2-star shield. I said, you're promoted. I did it right then. What did I just do?
Well, you gave him total credit for everything he did.
What I do to those other guys? I
motivate them to succeed.
All those guys that are hungry, they're going, oh shit, man, I'm ready. Like, I hope something happens in my place because I'm going to do it. You get it?
Yes.
All right. What else?
Has your approach to leadership changed, or how has it changed and evolved based on each kind of successive jump that you've experienced in your career?
It's my approach is always, you know, it's kind of like what the way I tell my kids. You go to school, you hang out with other kids. They're good kids, bad kids. You know who they are. You're smart enough to know. You follow and hang with the good. Get rid of the bad. Leadership is the same thing. You're going to learn from people. you're going to meet people, there will be mentors, the people that you can, you know, you can follow their lead. Okay, well, those, you know, you're smart people. You're not morons. You follow the leads. Those that aren't, you know, put them on the side. And that's kind of what I've done. If you listen to what I've just said the last 2 hours or so, 3 hours, what you do, I've learned from Rudy Giuliani. I learned from President Bush. I've learned from Jack Walsh, who ran GE. Kenny Langone, creator of Home Depot, the founder of Home Depot. Brilliant guy. I've monitored, watched, listened, learned from these guys, and I take the good that I like, that I think is effective for me, that I think I can use in some way, and I use it. The stuff that doesn't work for me, I don't use it. So, you know, technically, I mean, you should always be moving up, and that's the way it works.
And that's what we're doing here.
And I'm going to tell you something, and I'm not blowing smoke on this guy. I've known this guy a long time. You can't, when it comes to leadership and accountability and business management type stuff, nobody's better than him. So if you can't learn from him, I don't know, give it up. Go back to school or something like that. But he's the perfect guy to learn from. So.
Thank you very much. How did the time in prison change your concept? Or did it?
It did not. No. My prison time reaffirmed everything I thought, because I saw within the federal prison system, I saw corruption that I was astounded at. I saw incompetence that I was shocked by. And I saw enormous waste of money that is sort of an hypocrisy of what we're supposed to be. And it just reaffirmed everything that I've done. Everything I've done, you know, today, as we speak today, in the New York Daily News, does a massive op-ed piece about Rikers Island. And basically what it says is, since I left, it has gone back to the way it was before I took over. Now, that's a horrible thing. Except I couldn't be more happy, because before I got there, nobody in the history of New York had ever fixed it until I did. Since I've been gone for 13 years, it's gone back to a complete mess, and they have 10,000 less prisoners. So all that is for me is a vindication that everything I did was the right thing. My time in prison did not change my leadership thought at all.
Sir, this is just kind of a thought that I had. When you were in prison, you saw all that corruption and everything that happened. Did you just feel like, at that point, really frustrated?
You feel frustrated, but it's more than frustrated, because there is it's way more than frustrated. Because not only because you can't do anything about it, but the deprivation of freedom is far more profound than anybody in this room could understand unless you've been there. You know, people have often said to me, you know, you were in a minimum security camp. It wasn't a maximum security, supermax, medium. It's a minimum security camp. You have much more freedom than in a regular prison. You're in a dormitory type setting, you live with other men. Okay. I get it. Country club, club fed, all that shit you've done on TV. Here's what I would tell you. You all standing this whole time? Everybody? Okay. No? All right. If you go upstairs, go to the bathrooms. Bathrooms are pretty nice. I saw our room. Bathroom's okay. The bathroom upstairs is about 12 by 12, 12 by 15. Right? That's about the size of the cubicle. All right. So if you want to know how luxurious it was for me to live, go upstairs. Take as much of your personal clothing as you can and put it in that bathroom. Put it in the tub, baby. And then turn around and lock the door. and I'll come back in a year to get you. And you tell me how luxurious it was. You tell me what it was like to sit there for you. You tell me what it was like to live out of a Tupperware dish, or to cook your food out of a microwave, or to have somebody walk into the mess hall and snatch food out of your plate. And then you tell me what a country club is like. So when you see those newspaper articles that somebody got a slap on their wrist and got sent to a country club, I want you to think of that. Anything else?
You said that you had something new with the prison reform you're working on. Can you tell us about that?
Look, the things I've done, all the stuff I've talked about that I've done, nobody in the history of this country ever, and it's a long history, with my background, experience, or success in my field, in policing or correction, has ever been within the system, ever. You've had governors locked up, you've had congressmen, you've had, you name it, people, nobody that ran two of the largest law enforcement agencies in this country, no one has ever been inside. I was the first. Hopefully I'm the last. So I have a perspective that I promise you nobody in this country has had. And now that I've gotten that perspective and I've seen the flaws and failures, I'm on a mission to change it. I don't think that we can allow the system to continue to, it's unsustainable financially, number one. Number two, it's destroying families. And this goes up to something Steve said earlier. We talked about the drug wars. I was a drug addict. I was an undercover. I locked people up for drugs. But I have to tell you, when I look back and I think of those low-level first-time drug offenders that were selling to me, they were selling to me because they were complete junkies. They were stoned out of their mind. Okay? What do we do with them? We put them in prison. What else do we do with them? Nothing. We did nothing with them. We just put them in prison. Okay, you tell me what the benefit is to society. Nothing.
Because prison is a training ground for thuggery and criminality. Prison turns people into monsters. Prison institutionalizes men and women. So what do? We take a young kid that's on the verge of becoming a junkie, and we guarantee that that guy's going to be institutionalized, he's never going to get a job, he's never going to have success in his life, and he's going to come back out because he can't have any success and he can't get a job because now he's now a convicted felon. And we're going to make sure that he goes back and does the same thing all over again, or he goes out and kills somebody looking for money, and then he goes back to prison. That's what we guarantee. It's got to stop. People that have dependency problems have got to be treated. The mental ill don't belong in prison. They need to be treated. And that's another one. That one, I can't tell you how many people with mental illness, the answer for the government is just lock them up. All right, you know what? Don't lock them up. Put them up against the wall like ISIS does and then slaughter them. Just kill them all. Because eventually that's what you do. Anyway, I don't want to get off on a tangent, but that's what I'm focused on.
You said when you went to work for NYPD that 15 years later reaffirm that you made the right decision. What was that moment?
When I became police commissioner. It took me 14 years from the day I joined the NYPD in 86. I became police commissioner in August of 2000. 14 years and a month.
Relevant to that, you know, you're going into something enormous, something that you worked your way up to. That's an enormous responsibility instantly. How did that day, you just start by attacking that to get coordination out of it? I mean, in your words.
People often ask me, so what is it like to be the New York City Police Commissioner? Does he know what it's like? It's like being anointed king. know why? Because everything and anything that happens in New York City, you are responsible. Think about it. It's New York City. The budget of New York City is bigger than 40 of the state budgets. I don't think. It's an insane job. Now, what do you think? Quite honestly, you don't think. You ain't got time to think about that. You just do it. You know, there are things to do, and you just have to do it. I already handled a big agency. I got to be honest. I thought I had an enormous agency when I had correction. But when you have 55,000 people working for you, and you have more than a $3 billion budget, and you're responsible for the city of New York, your whole focus changes. So it's, you don't think that much. You ain't really have time to think. You just got to do it. Anything else?
What are your strategies on recovery from setback and failure?
I got to be honest. In the way I operate, failure is not an option. People look at me and they say it's unrealistic. I don't know. It's never been unrealistic in my book because I've never failed at any job I've ever had. In fact, every one of the jobs I've had, I've gone from the bottom to the top, including the biggest in the country. So I don't know. You know, failure is not an option for me. I just do it until I get it right, and then I do it until I do it best. I don't want that to come off arrogant or anything like that, but I mean, I think if you look at my background, if you look at what I've done, that's the way I've operated.
And everything else in the way is just something you have to either adjust or get out of the way.
Is it? No, there's a sign. I forget how it goes, but you see, you know, I'm moving up the hill. You're either with me or get out of my way, or I forget what.
Leave follow, get out of the way.
Yeah. Well, anyway, there it goes. That's it. There's nothing better than that. That's pretty much tells the story. So, yeah.
You talk a lot about keeping stats, and then from this point to this point, and then measuring the gaps, and then filling in the gaps. Can you elaborate, like, how you came up? I mean, was it just watching all the other leaders, or where did that come about?
I think mostly it came about understanding the concept of collecting data and how to use that data. Okay. First of all, you're going to collect information. Make sure the information is information that's useful to you. Don't collect a bunch of nonsense that you don't need. And believe me, when I say that for a reason, because a lot of companies, a lot of places will do that. They'll collect all kinds of shit. What's this for? I don't know. We just collect. I don't know what it's for. Okay. First of all, and this goes back, goals and objectives, mission statement, performance measures. Those performance measures are the stats. Okay? Your goals and objectives are to meet your mission statement. You know what the mission statement is. Okay, well, you're going to create the goals and objectives to hit it. And that's where the stats come from. And then you create the performance measures to hit the goals and objectives. And what do I need to get there? I need to do this, I need to do that, I need to do this. So I'm going to collect that information and we'll make sure I'm doing that. If there's anything outside of that, throw it away. You don't need it.
Waste of time.
It's a waste of time, waste of energy, waste of resources, whatever. Last question.
I think everybody here in the concept of leadership feels that they want to impact our young people. Yet, as I get older, and I look at, you talk about the correction system, and how Rikers has gone backwards since you were there. And we look, whatever country we work for, Canada, doesn't matter. Politics is politics. Power is power. Lobby is lobby. Impacting.
And I know where you're going, and here's what I would tell you, and you identified the problem. Politics. Okay? in politics, and I'll give you a really, this is a really good example. New York City and Rikers Island. Pre-Giuliani, post-Giuliani. Okay? Big difference. Rikers, pre-Giuliani, post-Giuliani. Big difference. It's political. And it's political, and businesses should not be this way. Because business is capitalization. Business is yours. You're in command. In government, in politics, here's what happens. Bernie Kerr comes in and does something that's really good, and then some guy comes after me and says, oh, you know, I can't stand up there and say this guy did all this great stuff, so I got to do my own great stuff. Okay, dude, you got to do great stuff, but like, if it don't go the way it's supposed to go, you got to go back and say, hey, let's go back and do Bernie Kerr's work, because my thing ain't working. Okay, nobody ever does that. Political leaders, government leaders, and who's from Canada? Who's, did you say, you're from Canada, both of you guys?
Yes, sir.
All right, now I'm going to get political, because I have an enormous admiration for Prime Minister Mulroney. I don't know if you guys...
Harper now, Mulroney before.
Huh?
Harper now.
Yeah.
Right? Mulroney was before.
One, a guy that, if he said he's going to do something, did it. And I know him personally. And I will tell you something. When I went through my investigation and all the stuff that was going on, there's an old saying, you never find out who your real friends are until you have problems. Believe me when I tell you. That's true. It's really, really true. On the day that I was sentenced to prison, I got a call from Roger Ailes of Fox News. And Roger Ailes, who's the chairman of Fox, called up. He had somebody call me. And he says, I have a friend of mine that's looking for you. He wants to talk to you. Now, they wouldn't tell me who it was, but I'm not going to say, no, it's Roger Ailes. He's the chairman of Fox. I said, okay. Well, I get a call from the Palace Hotel in Manhattan. And I answer the phone. It's Prime Minister Mulroney. Mm-hmm. I answer the phone. I said, hello? He said, Bernie, it's Brian Mulroney. He said, I just saw what they did. He said, and I have to tell you, I think it's serious. And he went on for 15 minutes. Stay strong, keep your head up, keep moving, keep doing, keep this, keep that, keep this. Enormous inspiration. Really, really good guy. I'm sorry, I lost track there for a minute. Anyway, politics, people in politics, they always feel that they have to make change. Even at the demise of whatever the success was. In business, don't do that. Somebody's doing something that's good, whether you like the guy, you don't like the guy, you don't agree with him, you don't agree with him. If it's good, it's good. Don't take something good and break it because you disagree with the person. You know what I mean?
Yes, sir.
That's it. Thanks, guys.
Thank you much, sir. Well done. We're going to keep these guys and abuse them for a while. But
you know, he loves to do this abuse stuff.
Oh, yeah. But I'm sure your daughter would like to see more of the premises. And
we're going to cruise around.
Maybe grab dinner around 8.
Yeah.
I'll call you when we get done.
All right.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yes. Everybody want to get a picture with Jim here?
Yes.
Yeah, and we've got a photographer.
Thank you.
Why don't we come on up here and we'll do a
photo. I really appreciate
that.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Yes, sir. Anybody like to do an phone? Individual photo? Is it okay with you, Commissioner?
Yep.
Comment?
Good. Thank you so much. Okay.
Oh. Anybody would like to do an individual photo? Come on
great.
Up here. And
thank you. I got to meet her in the elevator.
All right, what are we doing?
A few individual photos, and then we'll do a quick group photo. You're the official photographer.
Yeah.
Here, well, let's see.
We have our official photographer, right?
Oh, what?
She's the official super photographer for the group.
So, over there, we'll shoot this way.
Are all of our recorders still running, or do we
shut them off?
No, I shut that one off. I didn't shut the audio one off.
Okay. You're up front here.
Shut that one off.
Okay.